Welcome back one and all to another episode of The Damage Report with me, John Arola, and very lucky to be joined on the show today by Farron Cousins. Farron, how's it going?
Pretty good. Just enjoying the insanity for a little bit. You know, eventually it's gonna get old, but right now it's still kind of fun.
Yeah. Well, you know, I want you to have fun, which is why, as a belated Christmas present, I set up utter chaos in DC to make sure that we'd have something fun to talk about. And I heard that you were a fan of clowns, and so I decided to fill Congress with them. But anyway, very glad to have you here. We are indeed going to be talking about what's going on with the battle to see if there will be a speaker at some point. I'm actually watching it live as we're recording this, and so if anything particularly insane happens, we'll be able to respond live. But in addition to that, we've got last night the big old brawl between Lauren Boebert and Sean Hannity. That's gonna be fun. I say let them fight. And aside from all the speaker stuff, we have other topics to talk about as well, including how a Tesla potentially being intentionally driven off a cliff is good news for Elon Musk or something. Andrew Tate suffering consequences that might hit him a little bit harder than even being held by the authorities. And then if you stick around for the aftermath, we've got robot lawyers, Fox News once again going after the unhoused, and the war against AI entering a new phase. So everyone stay tuned for that. And in anticipation of that, please hit the like button, share the stream so people know we're live. And if you wanna reach out to us, send us any comments, tweets, or super chats, we'll respond as we go. But with all that said, Farron, are you ready to start the show?
Let's do it.
Okay, let's have some fun. Let's start with this.
If you pick, Jim, just how insincere the insurrectionists are, we might probably shouldn't use that word, the people that don't want to vote for Kevin McCarthy.
They would disagree with that word.
Saboteurs.
So you can tell Republicans are getting a little bit frustrated with the process to choose a speaker when they're declaring that the defectors are insurrectionists and then realize, oh, bit of a loaded word in today's political rhetoric. We'll go with saboteurs, that's better. That's worse. That's someone who like surreptitiously hides a bomb or something or takes out your plane. Somehow that's better. But look, as frustrated as Fox and Friends are, I have a feeling there is no one more frustrated right now than Kevin McCarthy, because I was fully prepared to start the show today telling you that he had lost a fourth, a fifth, and a sixth ballot to become the speaker. But I'm looking at it right now. He's lost his seventh as well. It's not totally done yet, but unless everyone that remains leaves the room, I think he can't win. So it was already historic, and now it's seven times historic. He is losing over and over and over again. And I will remind you that as we've gone from ballot to ballot, he has incrementally been losing votes. If you take a look at the first six, he'd gotten 203 initially, that dropped down by the third ballot. And then in the fourth ballot, he began to lose, I believe it's Victoria Spartz, who technically still supports him, but is voting present. So we don't know the final count on ballot seven, but as of right now, I mean, he's starting off day three with another loss, Farron. What do you think?
It's just, how many more times can he continue to do this? I mean, eventually you would just think as a normal person, right? If you go and you lose seven times in a row, eventually you're gonna be like, you know what? This just hurts. I am a person and I have feelings and I have to go home and face my family. And they're gonna ask me, well, how was your day today? And say, not good. But no, this is just absolutely unprecedented. And I really do think that McCarthy and the saboteurs, they've dug in so deeply now that neither can back out. I mean, that's what's beautiful about this. Everybody is so hellbent on, you know, holding the line that I don't see an end to this. I mean, could this go into the weekend? I mean, could this go all the way through the end of the month? They seem willing to make it happen. McCarthy is not going to go anywhere. And they announced this morning, we're not going to make a deal with Democrats. Well, okay, then have fun not having a Congress for God knows how long, because that's where we're headed.
Yeah, and look, and that's where it gets unfortunate. So thanks, Debbie Downer, for reminding us that technically there are some things that they need to accomplish from time to time. For now, though, I can't speak for you, of course, but I can say that I'm ready for this to go for quite a while. Makes them look like absolute clowns, which is accurate. And so, you know, I don't especially mind. Look, devil's advocate, I guess. I bet he consoles himself and his core supporters, maybe his family members, his friends, if a person like Kevin McCarthy has friends, I guess everyone does, would be to say, sure, this is highly embarrassing and I will go down in modern history for this and probably nothing else. But because the opposition are such clowns themselves, like, can you be that mad when you are being pulled down and like stopped from doing what you believe is your right and what many people are telling you, a position you should have? And it's people like Matt Gaetz and Lauren Boebert. Like, I would turn, instead of shame, I would turn the rage at him. But by the same token, he was able to win over Marjorie Greene. And if he can win over Marjorie Greene, why are you having so much trouble winning over Lauren Boebert? The whole thing is embarrassing, honestly, for everyone involved.
Well, and I think a big problem that he's having with trying to win over these Freedom Caucus folks is that there's no real clear demands. You know, this opposition to McCarthy, as we all know, it actually started 2 months ago. Pretty much right after the midterms, Matt Gaetz was like, I'm not gonna let this happen. I've got my gang of five over here. We're opposing it. But they couldn't actually articulate why. So we've just been going along. And now, of course, they're starting to say things like, well, because we're gonna drain the swamp, as Gaetz said earlier this week, and we don't want the big alligator in charge of the swamp. Wonderful. That doesn't mean anything, though. Those are just random words you've put together. Lauren Boebert doesn't know what she's demanding either, because McCarthy has offered them the moon and the stars. He's even said at this point this morning, it came out like, listen, I'll go with your plan to where if even one of you objects to me, well, actually, get me out. Like, but no, even that they're like, nope, we're in this to win it. We just don't know what we want to win. It's nonsensical is the whole point.
I agree. And look, even to the extent that some of them have made some specific claims, it's difficult to see as anything other than I'm coming up with this now to lend a bit of, like, I don't know, dignity to what I'm doing, which is clearly undignified. But I'm very glad that you brought that up, because there's like nothing I want to talk about more right now than the concessions that he's made. So let's jump into that. Kevin McCarthy, it was leaked last night, is ready to make concessions to the holdouts. And you're probably wondering, which concessions? And my answer to that is all of them. Like, every single thing that you can identify that one of the holdouts specifically wants, it looks like he's ready to cave on basically all of it. And some of this could change with negotiations. But according to what we know now, he is going to change it to allowing just one member to call for a vote to oust a speaker. Two different sources confirm that. That's one of the big things that someone like Lauren Boebert would talk about. It isn't good enough to just allow five to do it. They want any one rando to be able to do it. So he's conceded to that. He's gonna allow more members of the Freedom Caucus to serve on the powerful House Rules Committee. They say maybe a third of the House Rules Committee, which is very powerful, has to do with a lot with how the House actually functions, what legislation comes up for a vote. So now more of the craziest people in the Republican Party will be able to determine what votes are actually held. And promises to vote on specific pieces of legislation like a term limits bill, border security. That might be Lauren Boebert's bill that she's occasionally talked about, I'm not sure. But those specifics too. Let's see, the New York Times confirmed the third of that Rules Committee part of it. Bills on allowing people to like make individual amendments to bills that defund parts of the government. Like, basically at this point, he has delegated so much of the power of the speaker to literally anyone who wants to kick him out at a moment's notice, as well as to the Rules Committee. And taken together, those are massive concessions. So he might become speaker as a result of it, but the speakership he'll hold will be the weakest it's been in literally decades. And to make it even more embarrassing, and this is like my main source for Schadenfreude today, sources say it likely won't get him to 218 votes. I mean, we know right now it didn't on the seventh ballot. Maybe they're still working out some parts of that deal, but it doesn't look like even making all of those concessions, giving in basically to everything that Lauren Boebert has pulled out of her wherever to say this is why it's a principled thing. None of that looks like it's gonna be enough to actually get him in the speakership. And so a guy that already came into this process looking desperate became far more desperate. And even that, Farron, it's left, like, what does he have left to give?
He could walk in there and be like, all right, listen, last concession. Every day before we start, I'll stand here. Each one of you just line up, kick me right in the grapes if you want. I don't care. Whatever it takes, I want to be the speaker. I mean, that's really, you know, the last concession he has to make, because otherwise there's nothing left of the speakership. You've given every piece of this to the, you know, the hardcore right. And the thing about this is, even if, let's say for a second, McCarthy doesn't win, he's going to be replaced with somebody who's probably going to be worse, somebody that will appeal to that Freedom Caucus. So however this ends, with McCarthy making all the concessions and winning or losing, and we get a Freedom Caucus person in there, they've won. And I think that's the big thing that they understand too. However this ends, they're the victors and McCarthy is the loser. So that's why they don't want to back down. They've got all the power and they've proved it, you know, seven times now, maybe eight by the time we finish here today. Who knows at that point? I don't think there's enough pizzas in DC for Kevin McCarthy to bus them in and try to, you know, bribe these people with pizza and soda. It's not going to happen. They've won. They've got you and he doesn't know how to get out of it.
100%. Yeah, you're totally right. I like your last concession. I think you should try it. I don't know if it would succeed, but I want to see this reboot of the Grapes of Wrath. But anyway, here's another concession that was made. This concession, by the way, wasn't even made by Kevin McCarthy. You're probably wondering, wait, who else could make a concession? Well, it's the Congressional Leadership Fund, Super PAC, endorsed by Kevin McCarthy and Club for Growth. So they announced a deal to stay out of open house primaries for safe Republican seats to win over people, saying, we're not gonna be doing the challenging that we normally do. If you will please just let this guy get through. Is that gonna work? Well, again, doesn't look like it, because as of right now, Jeffries is at 209. We'll see if in the seventh ballot, Kevin McCarthy has lost more votes. We don't know that just yet, but the whole thing is just, it's not looking good. And to your point, by the way, I do want to say about them having all the power. We have to remember one thing, one fundamental asymmetry between our opposition and us is that they don't care if everything comes to a grinding halt. Like, we find that to, at least in the long term, be terrifying, because no, like, we need to fix these problems. No, they don't. They don't care. They're not, there's some things they'd like to have done. There's nothing they desperately need to be done. They got the tax cuts multiple times over. They're doing just fine. The subsidies and all that have gone out. They would love to just hold this position. And so when Lauren Boebert goes on the news and says, every day we've shut this down is the day money isn't being spent, it's not really how that works, but it stops any new spending from being authorized, certainly.
Well, and I think too, Ronna McDaniel needs to come out. You know, she's still the leader of the Republican Party for now, at least on paper. She could come out and do whatever it takes to put an end to this. You know, she was interviewed yesterday. Stuart Varney on Fox Business gave her absolute hell for having no ideas, no solutions. And the solution that she should come out with is say, listen, we look like idiots. We've got the global media mocking us right now, not just here in the US, around the globe, people are looking at us and they're laughing. So what I'm gonna say as the chair of the Republican Party is, if you do not get this right, if you cannot get together and put McCarthy in there, when 2024 rolls around, you're cut off. Your primary challengers will be supported by us. We will not tolerate this kind of mockery of the Republican Party. She could do that. But instead, like she told Stuart Varney yesterday, she's like, oh, I'm optimistic. They're going to work it out. No problems there. Which is why, of course, she's struggling so bad as the leader of the party, because she has no ideas. She has no backbone. And they're just letting, you know, the wackos take complete control of everything.
Yeah. That would be a bold move. I mean, it strikes me as fundamentally awful for a party apparatus to do that, to support one pot. But I mean, this is a Republican Party. They could do that. Trump would, like, if Trump really cared, he could throw his weight around in that way. But that's a big step. We'll see. So I would put it as, that's like the biggest threat. Offering to get kicked in the nads would be right here. Here's an easy, doable one. Here's some advice for Kevin McCarthy. Have you considered speaking out in defense of yourself? Like actually standing up and saying why people should vote for you. Like we're on the 7th vote, and I don't know if anybody has missed this. He has not done that yet. Vote after vote after vote after vote. Many speeches have been given by many people, repeatedly by the same people. He has not tried in public to make the case, either individually to persuade them or to the country, to the Republican voters, to put pressure on people to support him. It's all this backroom stuff. So we'll see. He's at 19 votes down right now. We'll see if it passes the 20 mark, or I should say the 21 mark, which is the low point for him so far. We have a little bit of fun before we find out the final result. If you think that this has been embarrassing for Kevin McCarthy, I think that you're right. It's also been embarrassing for Donald Trump, who called up the defectors and tried to get them to support Kevin McCarthy, and they declined to do so. Now that looks bad for him, that he didn't move a single one of them to support the guy he endorsed. But he wants you to understand that this is actually a good thing. He bleated, "I actually think that a big Republican victory today, after going through numerous roll calls that failed to produce a Speaker of the House, has made the position and process of getting to be Speaker bigger and more important than if it were done in the more traditional way. Much like me again becoming president after having won big in 2016, gotten many millions of more votes in 2020, but supposedly not winning, big lie, and then winning again in 2024. It will be bigger than the traditional way." So I hadn't thought of it that way. That like, honestly, being like Nancy Pelosi and winning on the first vote, that's weak. You wanna lose and lose and lose, 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 then win. And that's a show of strength. Barron, what do you think?
I think it's absolutely ridiculous. But of course, you know, Trump had his feelings hurt. He calls all these people, he puts it out on Truth Social. You gotta support McCarthy. He's the guy. And I think he could end up doing good, maybe even great, he said yesterday. Mm-hmm. Well, and then the first vote happened yesterday, and McCarthy had lost another one. And he actually lost support from the day before. So Trump's endorsement, as it typically does, backfired spectacularly for the person he was endorsing. And when you have members of the Freedom Caucus, like Matt Gaetz came out yesterday and said that Trump's, it was sad. Okay, that's you know, treading a thin line there, buddy. You don't wanna make Trump mad. Boebert called Trump out on the House floor in her speech.
Yep.
They're showing him that, listen, we've kind of understood something in the last 2 days, and it goes back to that whole thing. We actually have the power. What are you gonna do, Donald? Are you gonna get on Truth Social and say that, oh, we're bad now? We've already got the support. We are taking over. We're the rightful heirs. The way I described it, Trump himself was the Frankenstein's monster of the Republican Party. Right? They created this thing. Suddenly they realize they can't control it. It's out there terrorizing the city. But then Frankenstein's monster created its own monster, and that is your Matt Gaetz, your Boberts, everybody in the Freedom Caucus, basically. So now the monster's monster is out there running amok, and nobody knows how to control this either, but they're not afraid of the former master, is the big takeaway here. And it's horrible for Donald Trump. He can send out as many posts on Truth Social as he wants, you know, saying that, oh, this is the plan all along. Because you definitely want to lose before you win, because then you look like a bigger winner. But we all know what he's trying to do. He's trying to console himself because his former protégés don't care what he has to say anymore, and that's the biggest hit to his ego he could get.
Yeah, they're just the fear is draining away. Like Matt Gaetz, as you said, Lauren Boebert being like, you know what Donald should do? He should get on the phone and talk to McCarthy. You're telling him what to do. And every time they make a move like this, I just imagine a velociraptor like laying a claw on the electric fence and testing it. And eventually they don't get shocked. And that's when you have Jurassic Park. They're not scared of him anymore. I think that Donald Trump has done actually a better job than I would have expected of not freaking out over this, because there is no way that he doesn't understand what I'm saying and what you just described. That as bad as you know, the midterms largely being blamed on him was, I mean, that's one thing to pick a candidate and have the vote, the candidates be rejected. That looks bad, but you can sort of say that that's on the candidate. When you're coming out and endorsing someone like Kevin McCarthy and a pack of people that say that they're MAGA, that you endorsed, that have always been closely affiliated with you, that not a single one of them would switch over is just highly embarrassing. And then to not have a single one of them, because right now he's down 21 votes. That's as much as he's ever been down. I think it's done. Not a single vote switched over after all of those concessions that we just talked about, which honestly, kind of a little bit messed up actually. Not one of you was being serious about the things that you said you wanted. Like, I don't like these people and I don't like the concessions, but I kind of feel like it should have earned a few, honestly, like speaking in defense of Kevin McCarthy. But anyway, the whole thing is just so embarrassing. I wanna just quickly play one last video and get your reaction, because it is possible that we could eke out a bit more embarrassment for Donald Trump. Charlie Kirk has an idea how we could make that happen.
Now, I did tweet this morning that I thought Donald Trump should personally fly up to Washington, D.C. and broker a deal, whether that's in favor of Kevin McCarthy, in favor of Byron Donalds. He did write the art of the deal. He was able to do Middle East peace with Israel and Saudi Arabia and the Emiratis. He was able to renegotiate NAFTA. He knows how to strike a deal, and he still has a lot of political power. I don't think it's actually in his interest to do this in favor of Kevin remotely. If Kevin McCarthy ends up failing, one of the leads will be Donald Trump's endorsement does not mean that much anymore. So you can't get half pregnant here. This is my advice to President Trump. I think he should fire up Trump Force One, fly into Washington, D.C., come and act like the magnanimous leader that he is, and call a meeting.
Please fire up Trump Force One. Please go to DC and go walk down on the House floor. And I want to see Lauren Boebert spit in your face. No, like, goddamn, Charlie Kirk is an idiot. First of all, no, he didn't write the art of the deal, you moron. Nobody actually thinks he wrote that. How could you possibly think that? And maybe this is sabotage, because this is not looking good for Kevin McCarthy. It was already dangerous for Trump to weigh in at all. If he goes in person, he's gonna end up looking terrible. Why would Charlie Kirk give him that advice, Farron?
It's so weird, just the godlike worship that you hear in Charlie Kirk's voice when he's saying this. Like, he did all of these things that I'm totally making up in my brain, but I genuinely believe he did them. And then saying, oh, well, he could Trump Force One and he can walk in there and get everybody in line. I don't know how you actually hit that level of either stupidity or just downright blindness to reality, but somehow Charlie Kirk is there. And I think he's somewhere in the middle between being blind to reality and just being painfully ignorant about things. But either way, Donald Trump is not the silver bullet here. He is not the great kingmaker that he and Charlie Kirk think that he is. He is a liability for the Republican Party. Everybody that knows anything has been saying that for, 7 years now. But they still can't grapple with that reality because their careers are tied to Trump, right? Yeah. And that's part of the problem too. When you hitch yourself to that wagon, you're stuck with it. Otherwise, you're gonna get left behind because you have put all of your stock into this guy. So Kirk has to do this. And again, whether or not he's sentenced Trump up for massive failure, which would be hilarious, who knows, but he's going to have to continue to defend Trump because that's what he has become now. This is his whole identity.
Yeah, 100%. Okay, we're gonna see if they launch into the 8th ballot while we're live, but for now we are gonna take a break. We come back though, I wanna check in on Lauren Boebert, who did not receive the sort of welcome on Fox News last night as she might have expected. We'll have that for you after this.
Nancy Pelosi's.
You haven't
precedence.
Answered my question. So if you have,
you cannot yesterday demand you supported, more responsibility.
Yesterday you supported Jordan.
Want less
today you're supporting
Sean,
Donald.
That's not the way this
Donald's.
Works. We need a check and a balance on the third in line.
Who
to the
is your fight? Let's
Look,
have
Sean,
a final answer.
I want
Who
unity.
Do you want to
well,
be Speaker
maybe
of the House?
That's for the conference to decide. We need to come together.
Who do you
and
want?
See
I'm asking who you want.
What does it look like life after Kevin?
Clinton. Yeah, just let them fight. So that was a representative sample of any 25 seconds from Lauren Boebert's interview with Sean Hannity last night. She's used to going on Fox News and, you know, there's no tough questions or anything. Not so in this case. She is trying as hard as she can to just repeat the talking points that she's come up. Every one of those lines I've heard her say a bunch of times in the last week, and he is not having it. I wanna give you more of the back and forth because this is not like a brief time where he's disagreeing with her. That was the tenor of the full interview. Take a look at this.
We need to find somebody who can actually unify the Republican Party. I have offered plenty
of names.
Let some other folks start offering
other alternatives. There are 203 people and you have 20. I respect the 20 of you. I respect all of you. But I'm asking you, based on your own words, who is your final, let's have a final answer. Who do you want, who will you only support to be speaker? That's not that hard.
I am willing to have conversations with the Republican conference to come up with a consensus candidate.
She keeps saying that over and over again. She doesn't want to say an actual name. If you go back to that video, she makes a face when he cuts her off that she did not like that. And then her little, thanks, Sean, I respect you too. Maybe that was an honest attempt at diplomacy at that point. But I want to play one more video because, look, I don't like Sean Hannity. I think he's terrible on TV. He's a terrible guy in general, terrible for America. But he is at least asking specific follow-up questions to try to get a representative to answer a straight question, which is just, who do you want to be your candidate? Here's his like 10th try at getting that answer.
The American people are certainly frustrated by.
I'm frustrated by you not answering a direct question. You said to President Trump, you said earlier today that President Trump needs to tell Kevin McCarthy, you don't have the votes.
We need to come up with a consensus candidate to elect a Speaker of the House.
You don't have the votes and it's time to withdraw. He has 203, your side has 20. Why is it time for him to withdraw and not you when he has so many more votes?
Well, Sean, he needs 218 and he does not have 218. We've been trying to work this out in private, as you said, for months. But Kevin McCarthy didn't even want to listen to us until his disappointing midterms. We all want a.
So again, you can see the visible frustration. She like opened her mouth to jump in a couple of times. He's asking, I think, look, fairly fair questions there. Like she keeps saying he doesn't have the 218, but she has a tiny fraction of the 218. She will not address that. She just keeps saying 218. And honestly, as combative as they were there, and as much as I think she did a poor job of like defending her side there, that came out, that interview is before all of the concessions. Now that he's made all those concessions she asked for, like they really do look completely, they got so much out of this, Farron. Like so much additional power and specific crazy bills they're gonna vote on to still be against him at this point and pretend that it's principled rather than just, I don't want him as leader, which they don't wanna say that, but you could say that. That's legitimate. You could say, this is not actually primarily about a bill. I don't think he should be our leader, but they won't say that, but that clearly is what it is. What do you make of that little fight?
First of all, hilarious, and I loved every second of it. Because it is funny to watch Hannity sit there over and over and say, what do you want? It's like when you're dealing with a 2-year-old that's crying and having a tantrum, and you don't know, but you gotta fix the situation. So you're just begging them, like, just tell me, point to what you want, and we will make it happen. For the love of God, just do it. And she can't even do it. She's like, well, I think, you know, there's a person maybe somewhere that if we all agreed on it, we could do this. They have 10 times more people than you do, Lauren. I think you have your consensus candidate there. There's not even dozens of you. There's a dozen plus 8. That's what you have. You are losing in the numbers game here. But again, they've dug in. They've gotten all the concessions. And again, just to compare it to kids, it's like a parent saying, all right, listen, I'm gonna give you your snack, but after snack, you have to do your homework. Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, we'll totally do the homework. But then they don't do the homework and you say, all right, well, I'll give you one more snack, but then you're really gonna do that homework. And they still don't do it because we're dealing with people that are acting like children. And no offense to any kids watching this who say, I'm not like a Republican at all. No, you're not. You're far more mature. But that is the level that we're dealing with because these are truly people who I think genuinely don't know what they want or why they're opposed to this. They've been led to believe they are by Matt Gaetz, who's, you know, done a good job of blocking McCarthy, but eventually more conservative people are going to have to ask the question Sean Hannity did, which is, what do you want when all of this is over?
Yeah. And just my final point here, this is probably clear to people who've been watching the show so far, but like, I feel about them very similar to how I feel about Kyrsten Sinema, in that I despise them. No, but like, I don't actually think they're fundamentally wrong. I don't think they're obligated to support Kevin McCarthy or anyone. The reason I think they're wrong is that I think that they're lying about why they're doing what they're doing. Kyrsten Sinema is not obligated to vote for a bill. I just hate that she's lying about why she's opposed to it. Just come out and say, I don't like this bill because it might marginally raise taxes on corporations, or there might be a little bit more regulation on corporations, and I will never allow any of that to happen. I'm not here for you, I'm not here for the party or my constituents, I'm here for the corporations and the 1%. If she were to do that, I would still fundamentally hate her, but at least she'd be being honest. Lauren Boebert's not required to vote for Kevin McCarthy, but when she says, I will vote for him if he does these five things, and then he does those five things and you don't vote for him, well, then you lose whatever principle you were supposedly standing on. So we'll see, maybe in the eighth vote, but it's not looking good at this point. Okay, I think we should mix it up to a totally different topic. I'm sure we'll touch base with this once we launch into, or once we get to the eighth vote. But for now, why don't we totally mix things up and watch this.
This morning, after a dramatic rescue of all four passengers in a Tesla that plummeted off a 250-foot cliff in California, authorities have arrested the driver of the vehicle, charging him with attempted murder and child abuse. Investigators with California Highway Patrol say they believe the man, Dharmesh Patel, a doctor in radiology, drove the Tesla carrying his wife and two children, ages 7 and 4, off the cliff as an intentional act.
So at this point, these are allegations that it was an intentional act. But if this is true, this is a tragedy. I mean, it's a tragedy either way, but if it's an intentional attempt to kill members of his family, this is just a devastating thing. There's no reason that politics needs to be involved in this. But if you were inclined to push past the tragedy to make this about politics and the fact that it's a Tesla, I don't know, I would probably make some sort of comparison to the Tesla stock price going off a cliff or something. Beyond that, I don't see how this is good news for Elon Musk, but maybe I'm just not a good enough cultist of his, because fans of his have tried to make this out to be a good thing. And we're going to give you a few examples of that. But first, here is more info on the actual rescue.
Rescuers rappelling down the cliff saved the two children first. Then a helicopter crew hoisted the two adults from the mangled vehicle. All were rushed to the hospital.
The damage to the vehicle would indicate that it hit and then flipped several times. Landed mostly on its wheels. We immediately went, put a plan in place to lower rescuers down to the vehicle to get eyes and assess what we had.
Authorities say it's very rare for people to survive such a steep fall, and that the children's car seats may have saved their lives.
We were actually very shocked when we found survivable victims in the vehicle. So that actually was a hopeful moment for us.
Yeah, it's honestly, when you see that, it's shocking that anyone survived, let alone everyone. It is, you know, it's a secular miracle that that actually happened. But right there, you saw rescuers say that the child safety seats probably saved the kids. Nuh-uh, it ain't those that saved them. It's Elon Musk, or at least that's what I see on Twitter. Bill Sparrows tweeted, those kids owe their lives to Elon Musk. Like him individually, not the engineers who designed the car, not random chance, not God himself, but Elon Musk, the guy who technically is CEO of Tesla, even though he probably hasn't thought of Tesla in a few months, it's probably him. Jason says, this is why I drive a Tesla, safest cars imaginable, assuming they're not bursting into flame. He might have a point. Teslanomics says, if you're gonna fall off a cliff, you wanna be in a Tesla. I don't know, I'd probably avoid the falling off the cliff part of it, but Farron, there is nothing that they will not twist. Like honestly, when a Tesla bursts into flame, they'll probably say like, if I'm gonna be caught in a blizzard, I want it to be a Tesla. So at least it might warm me up. What do you think?
It's so weird, you know, to watch how these people react, because I think they genuinely think that not only was Elon Musk the guy that personally designed these vehicles, but that he is in that workshop, just him personally putting together each and every one of these cars, kissing it goodbye. Like, guys, he probably hasn't seen the inside of Tesla in months. Like, he doesn't know what's coming off the assembly line. He doesn't know what the engineers are working on, most likely. And he is not the one designing these safety features. You want to thank somebody? You want to owe your life to somebody, as they said in that tweet you read? You owe it to the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration. You owe it to the activists who fought for decades to increase the safety features in your car. You owe it to the government who put these regulations in place to make cars safer. I mean, that's who you should be thanking. Elon Musk didn't put those airbags in. He's not the one who installed the car seats. That was done because we have good laws that protect motorists.
Are you implying, Farron, that if we didn't have those regulations, Elon Musk wouldn't demand those things anyway out of the goodness of his heart? No, definitely not. Yeah, I don't think them being alive can go to Elon Musk. I personally don't think, I know people probably assume like, oh, you probably hate Tesla because you don't like Elon Musk. No, like I don't think Tesla has much to do with Elon Musk. So I don't hate it as a company. I hate some of its corporate culture and the culture of racism and sexual harassment and all that. I certainly hate that. In terms of the cars, I don't know how safe they are. I don't assume that every Tesla is gonna burst into flame simultaneously. But I also, again, I just want everyone to accept what Farron just laid out, that he was the CEO of Tesla, eventually, not even initially. He was a manager. He's not a coder. He's not an engineer. He is not Tony Stark. Like, can we finally push past that? He's not like, oh my God, I have a great idea at midnight. I'm gonna rush down. Oh, and then prototypes. He doesn't do that. He doesn't do any of that. He comes in every 3 months and demands something. And maybe some of his ideas are good, but it is the combined effort of hundreds of people who get it done, not him. It's all I want. Anyway. For some time now, Andrew Tate has been held by Romanian authorities under allegations of sex trafficking, rape, a number of different criminal allegations. Not necessarily individually against him, but some against him and some against his associates. And I'm sure that that's gotta hurt him, considering his high profile, regrettably, as well as the fact that this came about at the tail end of an incredibly embarrassing set of interactions with Greta Thunberg. But as much as that hurt, I'm not sure it'll hurt as much as this. His Bugatti and 10 of his other luxury cars have been seized by the authorities. So now he doesn't even have anything to lord over Greta. Poor guy. Anyway, they seized the car collection estimated to be worth over 5 million euros, as well as a number of buildings, including one where the brothers lived and allegedly held 6 young women. Apparently, they are now going to be held, 4 suspects, including Tate, for 30 days after a judge lengthened their initial detention period of 24 hours. The decision was not final, and the subjects have the right to appeal. So, you know, don't lose the fact that they could potentially be out at any given time. But right now, this looks more serious. If, in addition to being held, it gets lengthened, property is actually being seized, Farron, it looks like this thing is developing fast.
Yeah, if you come for Greta, you best not miss. I think that's the big lesson here. Listen, this week, I actually had the opportunity to speak with somebody who is a human trafficking survivor. She's now an attorney and advocate working on behalf of human trafficking victims and survivors. And one of the things we talked about was the recruiting methods that these traffickers use. And trafficking, by the way, doesn't necessarily mean like the movie Taken. A lot of it happens within the home. A lot of it happens in relationships. A lot of it is unhoused people that kind of get sucked into this. But what we've learned about Andrew Tate, mostly from what he has openly admitted over the years, is identical to what human traffickers do. This whole lover boy scam, basically. They psychologically manipulate these women. They can be physically abusive. They're always verbally abusive, sometimes sexually abusive. And that's one of the things that this woman I spoke to talked about, was the fact that if you take somebody that has been abused, whether sexually or even just physically repeatedly, and you can threaten them and you can say, listen, you've been through these horrendous situations before. I don't want to have to put you through that again. So instead, go work on this webcam thing for me. Let's go make money over here. And that, of course, was one of the businesses, I guess you would call it, that the Tates had been running. So it's horrifying to read these stories about Tate, because again, I've worked very closely with this individual for quite some time now, and I've heard the stories. I've talked to other victims, and it's just, it's textbook. It is textbook of what these traffickers do.
Yeah, I think you're 100% right. It is just the entire, every bit of it is disgusting. We get a little bit of, I guess, Schadenfreude out of, you know, Greta making him look ridiculous, but only because in comparison to how dark the entire thing is. And more details come out, and every detail is absolutely terrible. Apparently, 7 years before his most recent arrest, he was investigated over allegations of sexual assault and physical abuse in the UK at that point. Two women told Vice World News they were violently abused, one raped, the other repeatedly strangled by Andrew Tate himself. And the UK police and the Crown Prosecution Service mishandled their case, leaving him free to, of course, develop his career and go on to, at least allegedly, abuse and victimize other women as well. Apparently, police took 4 years to pass their investigation to the Crown Prosecution Service. That's the organization whose job it is to assess whether there's a realistic prospect of conviction, at which point they declined to prosecute. One woman said that Tate used a similar method of emotional and physical control in his UK webcam business back in 2015 before he headed over to Romania. When I said that he saw that he was arrested in Romania, I was shocked and didn't know how to react. I cried. Everything I read is what I told the police at the time of the complaint. If the CPS had just pulled their finger out, none of this would have happened. And not only would he have been brought to justice, but a lot of people might not have suffered as much as they did over the years. So that is definitely something that needs to be looked into, that decision. But the thing, Farron, for me that's so terrible about this is, it, in a much darker way, it reminds me of some of the Elon Musk stuff. It's bad enough the individual crimes they do, but when they're able to generate this cult following that no amount of revelation of who they actually are, the terrible things that they do, the things that they believe and advocate for, seems to be able to crack. Elon Musk is as beloved by his fans after months of him being an absolute buffoon on a daily basis. And, you know, if, I don't know if Andrew Tate ever makes it out as a free man again, but if he does, I guarantee he's gonna have a loyal following for his videos or whatever the hell it is that he does for money. And that's just so depressing.
Well, and we've already seen, you know, the Tate supporters coming out, you know, all these little weirdos on Twitter, the whole Matrix thing, right? When he was arrested, like, oh, it's whatever reference they're trying to make there. I don't even fully understand it, but they are willing, like you're right. They're willing to excuse anything that these individuals are accused of, whether it's Tate's cult, Elon's cult, Trump's cult. It doesn't matter because they have invested so much of themselves into these people that they will not see the bad things. They will always have an excuse for it, or it will always be made up, right? You can't believe these things. It's not true. But it's because they have put themselves into that person, right? It's not just that you're attacking Elon, you're attacking them. And yeah, they take it all just as personally. And it's this deep, you know, psychosis that takes hold of these individuals. And we've got to find a way, and I don't know how to do it, but we have to find a way to pull these people out of it. It's okay to have heroes. It's okay to be like, hey, I like this musician. They're really great. But if they do something terrible, I'm not going to excuse that. I'm still going to think it's bad. I think a great example of that, you know, is you know, everything Michael Jackson was accused of, right? Mm-hmm. Some great music. I'm not gonna turn it off when it comes on, you know, my Pandora station. But you have to be able to understand people do bad things. People can create good things and be bad people. That doesn't make the good thing they've created a bad thing, but they lump it all together. This person is great. Everything they've done is good. If they've done something bad, it's because somebody's lying about them somewhere. It's just, I don't know. I can't even describe it.
Yeah. Well, certainly a long battle we're gonna have to continue to be engaged in. An alternative to these just terrible predators who are preying, in this case, literally on women, but also on men, to try to make them want to be like them. There has to be an alternative presented to that. Okay, I could talk about that for a long time, but we do have one more story I want to talk about in the time we have remaining. So I want everyone to be warned, this is a video showcasing police brutality. So bear that in mind as we go forward.
He's hitting her?
So what you're seeing right there is a cop in New York repeatedly bludgeoning a 14-year-old girl, Kiana Robinson, in the back of the head over and over and over again. A full-grown man, a 14-year-old girl, as fast and as hard he can bludgeon the back of her head, that's what he's doing. And it apparently started when Kiana Robinson's 12-year-old sister got in a fight with another girl earlier this week. I don't see how any of that should lead to a full grown man brutalizing a young girl, but it's hardly novel in America right now. So leading up to the full video, there's more video available. Apparently, Kiana Robinson saw an officer pushing her sister or putting her sister in handcuffs. She's seen approaching and then nudging the cop who pushes back. Now, as a result of this, the NYPD is investigating. They say they became aware of the incident that occurred on Staten Island when officers responded to a fight between a group of youths. The actions of these officers is under investigation. One officer has been suspended. I love how passive that tweet is. They responded to a fight, not are clearly on video beating a 14-year-old girl. We'll leave that to you to research and figure out. So incredibly passive. They say this, by the way, we're gonna look at the body cam of the police officers. That's why body cameras are good. We're gonna use the video that was posted on Instagram. I was not pleased with what I saw in the video. That's Eric Adams, okay? Then retired NYPD Sergeant Keith Taylor says, the officers may not have known the age of the individual. The fact that the officer was hitting this individual above the chest and the head area, that would be an initial cause for concern, but without context, it's difficult to understand why it occurred. No, I mean, look, yeah, I wonder why it occurred, but I don't know what context could come out that would justify what we saw. Look at the body cameras. Sure, we should have body cameras. If we have, we should look at them. But nothing on the body cam is going to magically make the video that we've already seen not have happened. That happened. And if someone wants to come up with a bit of context that makes it acceptable to beat the back of the skull of a teenager, okay, you can try, but I don't get it, Farron. What do you think?
Well, John, you don't know that the cop knew she was just a teenager. The cop may have thought it was a 50-year-old woman he was bludgeoning in the streets of New York. Like, why does the age even matter at that point? Like, yeah. I didn't know she was just a kid. I wouldn't have almost killed her. But I think that is what we're dealing with. With these just renegade police officers throughout the United States. I mean, we're lucky that this young woman is not dead. I mean, we have seen far too much of it. The report that came out this week, 1,176 people killed by cops in 2022, only 12 days out of the entire calendar year when cops didn't report killing someone, just 12 days. And I hate to say, look at the silver lining that they didn't kill her, but my God, that's almost where we are with police in the United States today. We have to be glad when they just beat somebody instead of murdering them in the street.
Yep. That's the tragic ranking system we have to have here. By the way, one other, Carol Smith, retired NYPD officer, says, imagine being put in that situation and how would you react? Well, hopefully not the same way. Hopefully their training and all of that would cause them to react better than me. That's how I would respond to that. Anyway, that's all the time we have for our first hour. More show to come in the aftermath. We'll see you after this.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.